Thank you very much. This is an issue that has been very near and dear to my heart of late because of the evictions that were just spoken about. But I wanted to give a little background as to how I got involved in the issue in the first place, because I had not been involved in homeless rights issues until just a few years ago. I don't consider myself at that time as having any particular expertise or experience with dealing with homeless rights issues. How I got involved in the issue was, frankly, the First Amendment aspect of it, that homeless people in my neighborhood, Uptown, where I've lived for over 30 years, had been being threatened with eviction and various forms of harassment. And I have, as was mentioned, actually, I would think, a fair amount of experience, a practical experience in exercise of the First Amendment, the practical streets-based exercise of the First Amendment, particularly in this country, but equivalent rights in Russia, witnessing other folks trying to do their version of the First Amendment, as well as in Honduras. So that's where I approached it. What's been going on with the homeless here in the city of Chicago in terms of the Uptown neighborhood, I can't stress this enough. This is not just an issue of one neighborhood or one issue, because the attacks that have been visited upon people in Uptown are a threat to anyone who's trying to organize for their rights on whatever issue in this town. And Chicago being the third largest city in the country, I think we can have an impact nationally perhaps as well, whether for good or for bad, depending on what we do. Even if you have no particular interest in homeless rights issues, you're involved in other sectors, I think that the attacks that we've recently seen in Uptown should concern you. So that's what I see as at stake in the fight for the Uptown tent cities. The other things that I want to talk about today are why Chicago leaders are so dead set against homeless people. And for shorthand, I use, why do they hate homeless people? And I'll go into that in a bit. The other thing that I wanted to talk about was how homeless rights issues intertwine with a whole panoply of other issues, race, domestic violence, just really every social issue just about that you can name, you will find some connection to housing issues. And I want to talk a little bit about how they all intertwine. And then finally, I want to speak about some of the most commonly offered solutions put forward both by city leaders, whom I think we should have a healthy distrust for, but also activists, well-meaning activists, and the limitations of some of those solutions that are being put forward, as well as what I see as more effective approaches to truly ending homelessness rather than just simply talking about it. Let me talk a little bit about what has happened in Uptown. We have had 5 evictions of the Uptown tent cities that occurred over a course of 2.5 days. We had the long-standing tent cities under the Wilson and Lawrence Avenue viaducts under Lakeshore Drive that had been long telegraphed by the city that folks there were going to be evicted so as to take care of needed fixing of the Lakeshore Drive bridge viaducts. They were crumbling. These are 1930 structures. They needed to be fixed. They were becoming a dangerous situation for not just the homeless, but anyone else walking underneath those viaducts. It was necessary construction. And so those of us who are involved in Uptown Tent City organizers, we saw it as our mission very early on, shortly after we heard about this construction taking place, to try to find alternative venues for people to camp, because people had established a community there. It was a self-protection device in that if someone was in need, there were others there who could say, hey, so-and-so needs some help or whatever, and can see about getting that help. But also, it was a very visible location, and I'll go into that a little bit, but that visibility also offered protection for folks. It's part of the reason why the city hated it. So we wanted to get an alternative venue that was similarly visible. And we chose the spot of a previous homeless camp eviction, the pedestrian mall in front of the now shuttered Stewart School on Kenmore Avenue. That had worked quite well for folks. We applied for permits. The permits were predictably rejected, not once, but twice. We appealed them. Those appeals were predictably rejected. We actually had a hope that the city would just simply do the right thing and actually grant a permit for people to stay there for 6 months during the viaduct reconstructions. People needed a place to go. There were not enough shelters for people. There were people for whom the shelters did not work, whether due to mental health issues or they were married differently sexed couples, for example. There were a number of issues why people were staying underneath the bridge viaducts in the first place. And we wanted to provide an alternative venue for them where they'd be relatively free, hopefully, of police harassment. We were rejected in that. This whole struggle began in early March of this year and eventually landed in federal court. And that fight continues on in federal court. And I can say a few things about that a little bit later. But what was at stake here was first and foremost an Eighth Amendment violation and also a First Amendment violation. Let me say a few words about the First Amendment violation. There's a reason why the city of Chicago was so focused on these 50 to 75 people under the bridge of viaducts. 50 to 75 people's plight as homeless folks dominated the headlines for literally months and months and months, far out of proportion to any stories about homelessness elsewhere in the city. And even according to the city of Chicago's dramatic undercount of homelessness, they claim that there's 5,889 homeless in the city. The Chicago Coalition for the Homeless says there's something over 82,000 homeless. Whichever figure you choose in that, it's clear that these 50 to 75 people getting all this press coverage, they were getting it for a reason because they were visible. It was a visible expression of the problem that the city has steadfastly refused to fix. Just a few other statistics on homelessness in the city of Chicago. According to the Chicago Public Schools, some 18,117 of its enrolled students, were homeless during the 2016-2017 school year. 5% of Chicago public school students, according to the CPS itself, are homeless. And of course, that's only counting those who are on the radar screen of the CPS. God knows about the other folks. Where the Eighth Amendment violation by the city of Chicago really comes in is the whole notion that you cannot criminalize a whole class of people simply for being. And that's exactly what the city of Chicago was attempting to do before the evictions, and now they've put that into hyperdrive subsequent to the evictions. The city of Chicago's position, as articulated by more than one ranking police officer on tape during the evictions, is that homeless people do not have the right to pitch tents either in Uptown or, for that matter, elsewhere in the city. And why this is an Eighth Amendment violation, cruel and unusual punishment, is that all of us as human beings, we need to be able to sleep. We need food. We need shelter and so forth. If we can't afford to get that, if we do not have access to shelters, let alone permanent housing, or if those shelters don't work for us for one reason or another, then we need to be able to sleep. In Chicago's weather, you cannot sleep much of the year without some kind of shelter. However, you know, jury-rigged that is. I'm very proud to say that some of our folks in Uptown Tent City, the organizers, led the way in providing the tents that became the visible symbol of folks who were staying underneath those viaducts. And that's what the city really hated. That's what the rich neighbors in Uptown, they really hated. The visibility of homelessness, not homelessness itself. Folks needed those tents. I mean, we've got a very cruel winter here. And as suits in other cities have found over and over again, cities cannot use petty ordinances, permit ordinances and so forth, anti-camping ordinances and so forth, to criminalize homelessness per se. And that was the basis of our Eighth Amendment claim in federal court. Now, we also have something here in Illinois known as the Illinois Homeless Bill of Rights. Very nice, flowery language. Zero enforcement. And I'm going to talk a little bit about this later because I think this is a real problem, not just with the issue of fighting homelessness and fighting for affordable housing. I think our movements, regardless of the issue, have been basically playing it on the cheap for a long time. We bought into the neoliberal idea that the only reforms that are acceptable are the symbolic and the inexpensive ones. And I think that's really been a huge disservice, where people will proclaim a big victory. Oh, we passed an Illinois Homeless Bill of Rights. Oh, look at the fine print. Really doesn't mean much. Can't enforce it in court. Not yet, anyway. Both the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless as well as Uptown 10 City Organizers, through our attorneys, are attempting to do that. But we still, that law still has to be demonstrated whether or not it's just flowery language or has real teeth. And we hope in federal court to be able to put some teeth into it, because heretofore it's just been flowery language. So let me move on to, and we can talk about the, you know, exactly what went down during the various evictions. Much of that has been covered in the news quite a bit, but we can talk about that in the discussion, as well as particulars of the various suits. But I want to move on to my second item on the agenda, which is why Chicago leaders hate the homeless. And again, this is shorthand, because hate or love, I really don't care whether Rahm Emanuel or James Kappelman hates or loves homeless people. It's what they do is the problem. And that's what I want to talk about. And if that is your yardstick of whether or not they hate the homeless, I think I'll give you some evidence that they truly do hate the homeless. Talking about James Kappelman, even before he became alderman in the 46th Ward, he led demonstrations against the last public housing project, public-supported housing, low-income, affordable housing project in the ward, the Wilson Yards project, which is above where the Target is in that neighborhood. He led demonstrations as a private citizen against that development. The whole notion of giving housing to poor elderly folks was apparently anathema to him. Immediately upon becoming alderman, one of his first actions was to try to stop the Salvation Army food trucks that had been feeding homeless folks in the ward, to stop them from coming into the ward. He led a drive to try to eliminate basketball hoops from the play lots in the ward, the theory apparently being that they attract black youth, i.e. gangs, i.e. poor people. We can't have them if we're going to gentrify this ward. That was a James Kappelman initiative. He has stood by while SRO, single room occupancy units, have been destroyed all over the ward. Now, according to One North Side, between 2013 and 2015, the North Side lost over 2,100 units of SRO housing. More than half of those units were lost in Alderman Kappelman's ward alone. Places like the Norman Hotel, the Lawrence Hotel, the Hazleton Hotel, the Hotel Chateau. And James Kappelman has not lifted a finger to stop these. The most recent one is the Wilson Men's Club Hotel, which, again, he has not lifted a finger to stop. And in fact, if that flipping of that SRO hotel is going to go forward, it's probably going to need his imprimatur in terms of permits, in terms of zoning. He could stop it right now. If he truly loved the homeless, cared about the homeless, he could stop it right dead in its tracks right now. Don't hold your breath unless there is enormous community opposition to him sitting on his hands, because this is the same man who a few years ago introduced an ordinance into the Chicago City Council to ban that particular hotel and one other like it on the near north side. There's a particular kind of SRO. It's actually the least expensive kind of SRO. And this ordinance that he introduced and tried to get passed in the city council was so odious that even the normally lickspittle Chicago City Council couldn't go for it. But he tried to shut down Wilson Men's Club Hotel a few years ago and fortunately failed at that point. But at this point, it looks like it will go forward unless there is enormous community pressure to save it. I mean, this will mean a loss of an additional 200 units of the most affordable SRO housing to be found in Chicago. It will be replaced with a market rate transit-oriented development, which will throw 16 token affordable units, their definition of affordable, which then there's a rather complicated definition of what is affordable. It's 60% of the what's known as the area median income, housing that's affordable to folks in that bracket. Now, given that we're talking about folks who are inhabiting really the least expensive SRO, none of those 16 units, let alone the net 184 that are being lost, will be open to the folks who currently live in the Wilson Men's Club Hotel. Another Kaplman classic has been attacking the social service agencies that currently inhabit the ward through zoning and also audits of homeless shelters and so forth. During the five evictions that happened over 3 days in Uptown, one of the shelters there was going through three separate city-inspired audits, basically an attempt to shut them down by saying that you don't have your I's dotted and your T's crossed. And this has been de rigueur for all social service agencies in the ward as Kaplman attempts to harass them into no longer being in existence. And for those who don't live in the ward, one of these shelters nearly did shut down just on Christmas Eve last year, the Northside Supportive Services Shelter at 941 West Lawrence. People may have heard about it. We made it a big cause célèbre ourselves as well as other organizations, because here you were attempting to shut down a shelter just on Christmas Eve. You couldn't get much more heartless than that. And thanks to community outcry, that shelter was saved. It had been threatened due to the state of Illinois budget nonsense. And private money and other money was found for this. But in the words of the executive director of the shelter, Kaplman did, quote unquote, absolutely nothing to save that shelter. It was community outcry, which I'll go into at the end of my talk in terms of what we need to do in order to actually not just keep things as bad as they are right now, but have a dramatic improvement of the situation of homelessness and affordable housing in our country in general. So another Kaplman tactic has been so-called defensive architecture. I pity architecture students, because my niece is one, but she probably has to put up with this from her bosses all the time, and that architecture, if you look carefully at it in urban settings, is very carefully designed to be anti-homeless. Bumps in park benches, lack of bus shelters. Well, Kaplman has raised this to a high art. There are virtually no bus shelters in the ward. There are virtually no benches in the ward. There was an infamous picture the other day that got thousands and thousands of shares showing a bus shelter, a picture of a woman who had walked to the bus with her walker, couldn't sit down because, of course, the city purposely did not put benches at that or any other, just about any of the other bus stops in the ward. So, and the evictions that I spoke about that happened between September 18th and 20th, those were not the first homeless evictions. There were evictions on September 26th of last year from in front of the Stewart School. There was an infamous evictions that probably got a lot more publicity from underneath the Lakeshore Drive Bridge viaducts during the Lewis and Mumford concert in the spring of 2015. Again, these are done at Kaplman's behest, and when you put them all together with everything else that's going on, it's clear that it's a part of a pattern and practice of criminalizing homelessness in the ward and in the city at large. Now, much of this stuff is, when they do it, they market it as, oh, we're trying to help people. We're trying to help people. So, for example, the new design of the underpasses underneath Lakeshore Drive, they're putting bike lanes. Hey, we're going to become a green city. We're going to have bike lanes that conveniently wipe out the place where the homeless folks have been staying there before the reconstruction. The Stewart School Pedestrian Mall, they just announced a plan to turn that into a nice community garden, again, to prevent homeless people from staying there. But in addition to these attacks on homeless folks themselves, it's not like they're just cheap and not spending money. They are spending money for rich people. Things such as the $15.8 million going to a luxury high-rise development at the corner of Montrose and Clarendon, TIF-subsidized luxury housing right on the park, prime real estate, $15.8 million of your tax money going to subsidize that. And the Stewart School that I mentioned, this was one of the 50 CPS schools shut down by Rahm Emanuel. Again, of course, Kaplan did nothing to oppose that shutdown. A few years prior to his shutdown, this school's wonderful architecture got $10 million in renovations. So after a whole series of community meetings organized by the city, probably spent thousands and thousands of dollars, where people said they basically wanted this for small business incubators and affordable housing, whether for seniors or generally, got all that community input. What happened? CPS flipped it to a private developer, sold it for $5 million after having invested $10 million in renovating it. So that's what's happened in terms of, once again, it's going to become luxury housing. And so you have to say, at least so far as Alderman Kaplan is concerned, he hates the homeless. His whole record speaks to it. But let me talk about the city more generally. There have been any number of pronouncements over the years by various mayors, beginning with Mayor Daley in 2003. He pledged to end homelessness within 10 years. Now, obviously that didn't happen. In 2011, Mayor Emanuel promised to recalibrate, whatever that term means, Mayor Daley's program to end homelessness. And then in 2014, fresh off of hosting the NATO summit, he promised to end homelessness for veterans by the end of 2015. According to the Chicago Coalition of the Homeless, of course, Chicago reported the largest increase in veteran homelessness between 2009 and 2016, a 20.2% increase. City reported that 10.2% of those who were homeless in 2016 were veterans, up from 7% in 2015 and 9% in 2014. So that's the reality. We have the city promises, and then we see what happens. So besides these press releases promising to end homelessness, we've had a whole series of press releases coming out of the mayor's office pledging to do various things about homelessness. There was a pilot program that was supposed to end homelessness for the 75-odd folks who were staying underneath the bridge of abutments. 3 months later, 75 people supposed to be housed within 3 months, only 18 were housed. A year later, only 57% were housed, and only 18 months later, six times the length of the projected program, they finally, according to their own statistics, met their goal long after the program was supposed to be over. But did they actually do anything? Because there was no new money. And so what happened is that other folks elsewhere in the city in other programs who might have gotten housed were not housed at the expense of the folks who were. So this pilot program, which of course has not been followed up with any substantive program in terms of dealing with the tens of thousands of Chicagoans who need housing, it just hasn't been followed up with. We've got 282,000 people on the CHA wait list, for example, who have applied for housing. That was before the wait list was closed in 2014. We've had the passage of something called the SRO Preservation Ordinance, which has barely slowed the destruction of the SROs, as I've shown. We've had the recently announced Neighborhood Opportunity Fund, which is tax developers who want to build high-rises in places like the West Loop, higher than has been heretofore allowed, are supposed to give money into this Neighborhood Opportunity Fund. But as we've seen before, things that are marketed to us as helping poor people over and over again end up being anything but. The TIF program, for example, was marketed as a way to redevelop poor neighborhoods, and we've seen what the TIF funds have been done. The Affordable Housing Trust Fund has, like the TIF fund, been turned into a slush fund under the mayor's control. The Sun-Times quoted a mayoral spokesman the other month who said that the revised affordable requirements ordinance doubled to $20 million the amount of annual funding generated and more than tripled the number of units, low-income units, constructed annually. And how many did that equal out to? 135 units. 135 more affordable units in a city of 2.7 million people, in a city where, according to the Chicago Coalition of the Homeless, we've got 82,000 homeless people. We got 135 units while 282,000 people wait on the CHA wait list. Now, other programs have been forwarded, and I've got to stress that there are good people who have latched on to these programs in some hope that something might improve. The Tiny Homes Program has been the latest cause du jour, you might say, picked up by Windy City Times, for example, picked up by other housing rights folks. But you have to really question a program that has the backing of someone like Ed Burke, frankly. You really have to question it. And there's a couple of reasons why you need to question the Tiny Homes Program. And I think that tiny homes are a great solution to homelessness in rural areas because it's low-density housing. But what we find over and over again, if you look at, there was a 2015 Harvard study, for example, that found that one of the single greatest indicators as to why people are jobless and hence poor is their lack of access to transportation to jobs. If you continue in a low-density mantra, such as we see in much of the South and West Sides, you're not going to be able to get the kind of transit density you need so as to get people to jobs. What you need is higher-density housing, affordable housing, and then you can have the transportation of the jobs. If you start putting all these tiny homes all over the place, you're never going to get the kind of density of housing that you need, such as the density of transportation, I should say, such as you see on much of the North Side, for example, where there's bus lines aplenty, there's L lines aplenty, they run 24/7 and the rest of it. So I think that aside from rural areas, tiny homes really aren't the solution to the kind of things we need. Another thing that's been put forward, again, under the guise of helping people, is so-called transit-oriented developments. And all but one of these in the city of Chicago, by my reading, have been oriented, frankly, to yuppies. They're market rate housing next to L lines for people who can already afford cars, probably use Uber and Lyft daily anyway. They're the people who least need the access to public transportation because they, frankly, have got other options. And yet, you get tax breaks for these transit-oriented developments. You get zoning changes. The Wilson Men's Club Hotel is slated to become yet another transit-oriented development. Again, not to serve the people currently living in the ward, but richer people moving in. Another thing that was notoriously marketed as a solution to not only homelessness, but poverty and violence, and we saw it during the course of the 1980s and 90s, was the destruction of our current public housing, the high-rises, the Cabrini Green, Robert Taylor Homes. This was a big mantra, particularly of the Chicago Tribune during the 80s and 90s. They say, oh, look at all the violence, look at all the poor people, we've got to be sorry for them. And what we saw was that poverty and violence were simply dispersed. According to Dennis Rosenbaum, a criminologist at the University of Illinois at Chicago, this was in Chicago Magazine a few months back, suburbs to the south and west, including formerly quiet ones, began to see spikes in crime. Nearby Maywood's murder rate has nearly doubled in the past 2 years. In Atlanta, which also makes the top 10 crime list, crime is now scattered widely, just as it is in Memphis and Louisville, where the cities follow this mantra of the problem are high-rises. The problem is public housing high-rises. If we simply disperse people, we'll take care of it. And of course, what happens in the process is they don't replace those units one-to-one. They don't track where people went from Cabrini Green. And people end up homelessness homeless as a result. And so we've seen this growing trend in the United States, the suburbanization of poverty, with the idea that if you push people out of sight, out of mind, then you've solved the problem. Another statistic along this, nationally during the 1980s and 1990s, poverty in the suburbs increased at twice the rate as in the cities. We've seen the exodus of black residents in our city, which is shorthand often for poor people being pushed out of the city because they can't afford it here, or the city has allowed neighborhoods to deteriorate to the point where they become unlivable for many folks. It's been a deliberate policy, and it's been a very profitable policy. According to one book that I'd like to give a brief plug to, How to Kill a City, gentrification wouldn't happen without having something to gentrify. You allow the West Side to have no social services through the course of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and into the aughts, and then all of a sudden, it's the hottest real estate market in the city, bar none. I say that as one who works in that neighborhood. No city services were poured into that area. You make the real estate so valueless that when someone comes in like Sterling Bay and picks it up, the profit rate that they can make in flipping it is just phenomenal. And that's what you've seen. They purposely allow a Cabrini Green area to deteriorate. They don't maintain the housing. They don't maintain the other services. And then all of a sudden, it becomes ripe for gentrification. And that's one of the things that this book does as a cross-city study of how they purposely allow areas to deteriorate. So when it comes time to gentrify them, whoa, big, big profits. So what I want to point out is that this is not an accidental policy. The CHA is probably, as people know, is controlled by the mayor, has been since Daley's time. And what has happened with the CHA has been intentional. This isn't a conspiracy theory, but you just look at the facts that are published in our newspapers, and it's clear this has been an intentional policy to destroy public housing, to destroy the CHA. This is an agency which is sitting on a $450 million surplus. This is an agency which, contrary to what's happening in the rest of Illinois, let alone the city, its pensions have been long overfunded. Overfunded. And yet you've got 282,000 people on the CHA, what I should say 282,000 households on the CHA wait list. Nationally, since the 1970s, we've seen more than a million single room occupancy units destroyed. A Harvard study that came out recently said that we're suffering a net loss of 10,000 units of publicly subsidized rental housing a year. This at a time when the polarization in wealth and income shows that people need more public housing, not less. And the private real estate industry hates public housing. And there's a very simple reason for it. It's competition. The more public housing you've got, the more affordable options out there, there is a downward pressure on the rental market. And so the private real estate industry in this country, in this city in particular, has had a war against public housing for the last 20, 30 years because it's competition. It's no accident that when I moved into the city in the late 70s, Chicago was a relatively affordable city, and we have seen those of us who've lived here long enough, the rents go up and up and up, and that's been part and parcel of the destruction, the wholesale destruction of the bottom end of the market, because now you've got more people chasing fewer units of housing, driving up the rental prices and the purchase prices of everything that's left. It's simple market economics, and our leaders are big lovers of market economics, so they should love that one. Now, I was going to go into how our various politicians have profited personally. People like Danny Solis, people like Alderman Burke, have profited personally from real estate contributions, from their war on affordable housing. In deference to time, we can go into that in discussion, but I'm going to just skip over that because I want to get to the last couple of topics, how housing is intertwined with other social issues and what we can do about it. How it's intertwined with other issues. I've touched on it. Lack of public transportation means people can't get to jobs. It means that their housing isn't worth much to them if they can't afford to pay rent because they can't get to the jobs. Domestic violence is intimately connected to the issue of homelessness. According to Chicago Coalition for the Homeless Study, 78% of individuals who are homeless lived, quote-unquote, doubled up, quote, often in overcrowded conditions. And anyone who knows about domestic violence knows that togetherness, if we will, is a recipe for more domestic violence. According to the City of Chicago's own point-in-time homelessness count in 2016, 26% of the people that they interviewed were domestic violence victims. Almost 86% of homeless students lived in doubled up in homes. 86% of the 15,000 homeless students lived in doubled up situations. And this is, again, it's a recipe for domestic violence. And we're talking about LGBT youth. It's a recipe for people needing to get out of the house. LGBT youth make up some 40% of all youth homelessness, despite representing only 7% of all youth. Homeless students identified by the Chicago Public School System, 97.8% of them were people of color. And you can go on and on. The one thing that I really wanted to concentrate on in terms of connected issues, though, was policing and homeless, because we have not just the egregious evictions that people saw in Uptown a few weeks ago, but it points to a larger problem. Resources that are spent on policing necessarily can't go to other things. That's the starter. Some 40% of the City of Chicago's operational budget is spent on policing. Mayor Emanuel's pledge of 1,000 new cops. Each of these cops come at a cost of $140,000 per officer in salary benefits to start.
Per year.
The new cop academy that they're talking about building, that's $95 million, again, down the toilet. And what's important to see is the context in which this is happening. Because the City of Chicago, and most people don't know this or prefer not to talk about it, the City of Chicago has got an abundance of cops. When you crunch the numbers from the 2016 FBI Uniform Crime Index report, which I have, you will find that the City of Chicago has got the third highest cop per civilian ratio of any city with more than 50,000 people in the United States. We are number three. There are 650 other cities of 50,000 people or more who've got fewer cops per capita. DC is number one, and Baltimore is number two, and certainly they've got no violence problem, not. But also, the FBI statistics don't delineate between various kinds of officers, state, federal, and so forth. So arguably, you could say that Baltimore and DC, if you're just talking municipal cops, may be at this less than Chicago. That's just my theory, if you will, unfortunately not backed up by statistics in that instance. But what you've got is a situation where the money that is being wasted on police officers will only keep the current situation intact, or worse, commit violence themselves. That's money that could be going to the kind of after-school programs, the arts programs, the music programs, the sports programs, the library hours that don't kick us out in 90 minutes here. That these sort of programs that Rahm Emanuel enjoyed while he was growing up going to New Trier High School, that CPS kids are deprived of that. And of course, again, connecting to other issues. We live in a country where the schools are even more segregated than they were at the time of the 1954 Brown versus Board of Topeka, Kansas decision. So we've the issue of homelessness in terms of who bears the brunt of these kind of policies is intimately connected to whole, because this money could be spent on homes for people. Let me talk in closing about some solutions. I'm not a Christian, but let me read to you, according to the Gospel of Matthew, what Jesus had to say. The poor will always be with us. There's this notion out in the world these days that we are always going to have homelessness. And that's a very ahistorical position. It's a very ahistorical position. According to Wikipedia, the longest running homeless advocacy organization in the United States was formed in Philadelphia in 1981. That's actually incorrect. It's actually the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless. It was formed in 1980. But what's striking was that for a whole period of time, from the 1950s through 1980, the issue of homelessness was not even on the national radar screen. There weren't organizations advocating for an end to homelessness. Yes, there was a housing shortage post WW2, but the whole notion that people have to be homeless and the government's got to do something about it or anything like that, that was not even part of the national conversation for literally a few decades. And those few decades, not incoincidentally, also coincided with a time when the income and wealth differentials between the poorest and the richest in this country were at their flattest. That's when you had almost no homelessness. At least it wasn't considered enough of an issue to even count, let alone have advocacy organizations. So this whole notion that we always have to have homelessness, that no matter what the best efforts of private citizens or officials, it's always going to be with us, is totally wrong. It's totally wrong. I've talked about some of the so-called solutions like the tiny homes and so forth, which I hope, again, good people can put these forward, but really they're band-aids on a gushing wound. What is not part of the national conversation right now, which urgently needs to be part of the national conversation, is a massive commitment to building more affordable public housing. And this won't be cheap. Each unit of affordable housing costs close to $200,000 on average. Okay? But what we've seen in the place of advocacy for more public housing, let alone defending what we've already got, has been band-aids. Oh, we'll build a few tiny homes at most. Or rent control. I'm in favor of rent control. Don't get me wrong, but it's a band-aid on a gaping wound. Because guess what? The two cities that have got actually the most rent control in this country, San Francisco, New York. We know how affordable the housing is there. What rent control does, it preserves some housing, hopefully, for people who are already there. But what you found is that when the real estate market is hot enough, like especially San Francisco, developers find a way around that. And that's what's going on in San Francisco right now. They've got great rent control, but people are being bought out. People die, like in New York. Their housing thus is no longer part of that whole pool. It just preserves what you've got. And it can be a thing where non-governmental organizations say, well, I passed this thing, this piece of legislation. Aren't we great? Shouldn't we get funding for the next year from Ford Foundation or whatever? I mean, that's sometimes how cynical it is. And you look at various initiatives such as the SRO preservation ordinance here in the city of Chicago, which has got huge loopholes, which have been successfully surmounted over and over again by developers destroying SRO housing, or our own homeless Illinois homeless Bill of Rights. These are token, it doesn't cost you anything, don't worry kinds of piece of legislation. And we on the left have got to move away from that, because the crisis in affordable housing is getting worse and worse and worse. It's leading to bleeding out of poor and black people from our city into the suburbs, where again, the problems of homelessness and all the attendant problems that come with it then are out of sight, out of mind. And we've seen this in Europe already. I mean, this is, you look at places like Paris and so forth. The big cities are ringed by poor suburbs because it allows the authorities to push the problem away. People riot out in Bensonville or whatever, wherever the future, you know, low-income housing might be. They don't care because it's not going to shake the power system the way it is when Cabrini Green decides to take things in their hands. And that's why they push people out. We need a real push for a massive public housing building program to give these private developers who keep on raising rents and so forth some real competition. And I should just say parenthetically, the city of Chicago likes to push that it's got like Section 8 vouchers and other voucher programs for private landlords. The problem with these is they help individuals, and they shouldn't be cut back. But the problem is they don't actually add to the housing stock. They simply end up giving subsidies to current landlords rather than building the market so that there's real competition for these private developers. It ends up just being a subsidy. Let me finish by saying something about nationally, because as I think I've shown with things like the CHA surplus and so forth, there are a lot of resources in this city. The $30 million that were just spent on a TIF development at Wolf Point. The I believe the $50 million that's being used for the bike path across the Chicago River. Most of it federal money. But there are truly resources in the city that could be used for the kind of massive public housing building program that I'm talking about. But more than that, we need to look nationally, because we live in a country that spends almost as much on armaments as the rest of the world combined. When we look at the United States compared to other wealthy nations, such as Japan, Western Europe, and so forth, many countries that have got much less wealth than the United States have got gold-plated social services compared to what we've got in terms of free higher education, public housing, and so forth. There's a reason why we don't have that in this country, because so much money is spent on controlling the rest of the world, hurting people in other parts of the world, and of course hurting people at home, because that money could be used for things like free health care, like free higher education and so forth, and it's not. Now, there were two big public housing booms in this city, two periods, motivated by two very different motivations. The one that probably most here are familiar with was the one that happened in the 1950s and 60s, which was a cynical policy of Richard J. Daley to segregate, to enforce segregation in the city by building things like Robert Taylor homes to keep black people confined to the areas of the city where they were, quote unquote, allowed. But there was another public housing boom that I think is much more important and inspiring for us to look to, and that's what happened in the 1930s when things like the Lathrop Homes, which is currently under threat, was built. It was built in 37, 38. And that's when we had a massive movement of people in the streets forcing these kinds of change. This was a time, 1934, for example, when you had three general strikes in the United States, demanding that working people be treated decently and have union jobs and so forth. It was a time when people were evicted by their version of Sheriff Dart. People put gathered in the neighborhood and put those things right back into the house. And that's what forced the authorities to do the massive public housing boom in the 1930s. Very livable homes, like Lathrop Homes was until fairly recently, because they purposely didn't take care of it. So we can do this. They did it during the height of the Great Depression, forcing massive building of public housing, not only here in Chicago, but also in New York. Now, unfortunately, when they did that back then, it was segregated. And that's something that we have to fight against. It was whites only, as were so many of the social services back then. But if our movement is going to really address homelessness and not fall for whatever nickel and dime policy, whether it's tiny homes or what have you, that's really what we need a commitment to, is a massive public housing program that will cost millions of dollars. And we should not adopt the neoliberal theory that we can only go for reforms that are quote-unquote realistic, that don't cost the system any money. It's been done before. We need to do it again. The need is very, very urgent, not just in the realm of housing, but in so many other respects as well. Thank you very much.
What is the number of beds that are available, like, say, on a nightly? Do you have a number for that? Like, you know, emergency housing for someone who is literally out on the streets.
I wish we had some of our expert witnesses who testified in federal court right here, right now, because it was very difficult coming up with any kind of global information. What the city of Chicago itself admitted was that as of the September 18th evictions, the only housing that they said that they had available was Pacific Garden Missions, which, for those who know that facility, it is a notorious shelter. I personally interviewed homeless folks who had stayed at PGM who said that their possessions been ripped off by staff, that if you are going to stay there more than just overnight, then you need to sit through religious services. And this is what the city of Chicago was saying. This is part of the problem of our whole privatization. It's far away from public transportation, and part of the reason why a lot of the folks in Uptown Tent City didn't want to go there is because their resources that they depend on for food and so forth, the mental health services, substance abuse, or whatever, are all up in Uptown. And public transportation may not seem much to those of us who can afford it, but it's a big deal for those who can't. And again, it's pushed people out from the expensive real estate, out of sight, out of mind. So I wish I had a definitive answer for you on that, but the city of Chicago was saying that they don't have, the only housing that they could truly guarantee people was at PGM, and this was during the good weather. And wow. The homeless folks will tell you themselves that over and over again in the worst weather, there just is not housing, even in shelters. And yeah. We've got a situation where some 48% of Chicagoans, according to a recent study, spend 30% or more of their income on housing, which is basically the tipping point between whether or not you are spending so much on housing that you can't take care of other basic needs, such as food and other things. So this is something that affects not just homeless people, but there's a lot of people who are literally just one paycheck away or one medical crisis away, especially if we lose ACA for all its faults. Previously, at least, medical emergencies were the primary cause of bankruptcy.
These are the my money capitalism is best measured by how cruel it is to those who are most vulnerable. To me, this is emblematic on a small scale. This is a very wealthy country. You just happen to spend everything on war.
I was at a demonstration that really crystallized the sort of, we can't talk about military spending in this country topic. It really crystallized it for me. It was a demonstration on the Bears opener at Soldier Field for Colin Kaepernick. And as we were walking away from Soldier Field, I looked up and I saw this huge monstrosity in the sky. I was shocked because I'd never seen one of these in person. I'd only seen pictures. It was a B-2 bomber, which basically looks like a big wing flying. It's stealthy, you know. I also happen to know they cost at least $2 billion apiece, and I could only imagine just the cost of the jet fuel to fly this wing over Soldier Field during the national anthem.
it was the insult, and we see it with our air and water show. And this goes to something I've got a real problem with social democratic campaigns, such as we saw with Bernie Sanders recently, and that there is no discussion of the U.S. military, the enormous military aid to Israel, which dwarfs the aid to all other countries on the planet, let alone aid in arms sales to places like, you know, that great human rights beacon, Saudi Arabia. You know, both countries, of course, practice systematic torture, whether you're talking to Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch. So it's like we're not only spending these billions and billions of dollars, record military aid to Israel, as put forward by Barack Obama, and now apparently to be increased under Donald Trump, And what is it funding? And so when Bernie Sanders says, I'm going to give you the sun, moon, and stars in terms of free higher education or whatever, he becomes a laughingstock because conservatives take a look at that and say, where's the money coming from? Yeah, some things like single payer will pay for themselves. They'll be cheaper than the outrageous system that we've got right now. But there's other things that cost real money. I mean, there was no mention that I could see about a massive commitment and dollars going into building the kind of public housing that I think is truly needed in this country, let alone the other things in terms of rebuilding our schools, in terms of having the class-to-teacher ratios that Rahm Emanuel enjoyed up in New Trier. I mean, you've got Susan Sedlowski Garza talking about 40-plus students in some of the classes in her ward. You certainly didn't see any mention of that in the mayor's recent budget address. These things cost real money. And if you're going to get up there and say, I'm a socialist and I'm going to give you this, that, and the other thing, people will say, boy, I'm glad Santa Claus is back, because how are you going to pay for it? And we've got the resources. I mean, it's no accident that during the Cold War, both the USSR as well as the United States had crappier social services than any number of the other countries they're allied with it. East Germany, et cetera, had far better services than the Soviet Union. We saw in Western Europe to this day, they've got better public transit. They've got more commitment to public housing. It may not be great public housing, but at least people are housed than you've got, you know, here in the United States. The donut hole that our first speaker spoke about in terms of the situation of homelessness and poverty and housing that was in Paris. Those of us who've lived in this city long enough will remember that periodically then Richard M. Daley, mayor, jetted off to places like Paris, and the media eagerly noted that he was taking notes about what he had done to make, you know, they made done to make Paris Paris, and one of them is you push poor people out, and that's where you push people of color out, and that's what they did in Paris, and in so many other cities. Talking about the sea change in opinion, see, I think it's been a sea change in the public dialogue, which is, as we know, is dominated by the Chicago Tribunes and so forth, the same people who demonize Cabrini-Green so as to destroy it, the same people who demonize public housing in general so as to give the CHA an excuse not to do one-to-one replacement to dilapidated units. Because one of the things that not only I but others observed during the time, many months that Uptown 10 City was going on, we were doing a cop watch because the cops would come down, they'd issue false tickets to people, they'd scare people in an attempt to push them out of the ward. We put a stop to that, I'm happy to say, by videotaping them and publicizing how they were issuing. You got to love this. I mean, the creativity of the CPD officers, it's truly epic. One of the things that they ticketed people for was violation of Parks Department regulations, staying in the park after 11 p.m., even though people weren't on Parks Department property. The even better one, though, was a violation of an ordinance, I can't remember the number, which says that you cannot park carriages or large groups of people or cars, note the vintage of that ordinance, on top of viaducts, because, of course, it's a danger. They might collapse or whatever. Well, of course, people were underneath the viaducts, but that didn't prevent them from citing people with these blue and white tickets, which they knew people weren't going to show up in court, but they'd take it as a signal to get the hell out of there, which is what they wanted. But one of the things that we saw while we're doing that cop watch, you'd be out there at 11 o'clock at night, and cars would pull up. Someone would pull out a case of water. Someone, you know, drop off some food. These were people, just regular folks, not getting any credit for it, certainly not a damn tax deduction. Oh, 501c3, here, you know, give me a receipt for this. People were doing it just out of the goodness of their hearts. They're dropping by, and we're there just watching for cops, and they're doing this over and over and over again. And that really reinforced my faith in some of my fellow uptown residents, and there are a lot of good people out there. The tragedy of the destruction of the 10 cities is manyfold, and one of them is that those people, those good people who tried to help people who didn't have housing, can't reach them anymore. The city purposely dispersed them. Mental health counselors, the DFSS, for when it's in its useful mode anyway, can't reach its own clients anymore because the city of Chicago keeps on shooing them away. We just had an incident just the other day. People who had been dispersed from Tent City had been covering themselves up with tarps just to survive. Someone had asked where people are hiding, where people are staying, and I said they're hiding with good reason because the city cops keep on trying to push them out of the ward wherever they're at. And people had their possessions thrown away in broad daylight in spite of them being accompanied. Just the other day. This is the kind of things that the city of Chicago is now doing. There has been a dramatic escalation in the war on homeless people in the city of Chicago that came in the wake of the evictions of the tent cities. One of the things that I have found very curious moving to this city in the late 1970s was how so many of the social services are not provided by the city. Certainly not provided by unionized labor. And we've seen over and over again under our great Democratic pro-union mayor how city services over and over again have been privatized, where they're talking about school janitors and so forth. We saw, of course, the shutdown of six of the 12 mental health clinics, and the others were privatized. And what this means is they're unaccountable. There's no central way to keep track of what they're doing, let alone whether or not they're being sectarian in the delivery of their services, as I would argue Pacific Garden Mission is. And this is a direct attack for a mayor and a city council that claims to be pro-LGBT to say that provision of so many public services should be done by Catholic Charities or PGM or whomever. What does that say to LGBT youth? What does that say to any number of people who are non-Christian who may feel like they can't access these services, whether rightly or wrongly, because they are not given by city agency, which is subject to public oversight, but instead is privatized. And we've seen this under both Democratic and Republican national administrations. I mean, we had, of course, George Bush's 1,000 points of light nonsense. One of the things, and I want to give another plug, this book goes through how they destroyed public education in New Orleans post-Katrina. They took advantage of the horrendous situation following Katrina to basically destroy and totally privatize public education. The title is How to Kill a City, Gentrification, Inequality, and the Fight for the Neighborhood. It's by Peter Moskowitz. It's really, from what I've read, really the best, most accessible way to discover what's going on, and it got me thinking about things such as the rent control. Why has it failed? And you got to say, for those who've got it, it's great. I'm glad they've got it. But in terms of a systemic cure for the problem of not just homelessness but of housing affordability, it only helps some people. It's not the kind of massive public housing adding to the housing stock that we need to lower everyone's rents.
I am a part of the mental health movement here in Chicago, and there is actually enough equity in Uptown to keep and maintain housing for those people in the tenant camp. But what's happening there? The pharmaceutical companies are fighting, trying to get those people housed.
I can't help but notice the contrast between how the opioid epidemic has been treated compared to the crack epidemic. All of a sudden you have people across the political spectrum thinking we need treatment, we need, that there's all this concern, and that of course, you know, Rush Limbaugh's addiction was treated very differently than the people that he castigated a few years ago. He's found to be hooked on prescription pain pills. So there's a real divergence when white people are the primary recipients of the epidemic versus black people. That's just got to be said. But what you were saying in terms of the pharmaceutical industry being thick as thieves is this, and our recent nominee for Drug Czar was caught up in all that, trying to run interference for the drug companies. There's the Charleston, West Virginia paper that found that 9 million doses of painkillers were shipped over a two-year period to a town of 400 people in West Virginia. 9 million doses. I'm still waiting for the criminal indictments for getting people hooked, but instead, you know, the people that get castigated for getting hooked, getting other people hooked, are people, poor people on the west side or and what have you. It says something about the class and race divergent in terms of our so-called war on drugs. And of course, how that relates to homelessness is that frequently substance abuse something happens in people's lives, they have a bad breakup, whatever, they go into drugs, and then they become homeless. And for women, so often, it's domestic violence. I read the statistics people earlier concerning that. All at the same time, is if when you look around our city, the construction cranes that dot particularly the west side, all of that is for luxury housing or luxury office buildings. You know, a few years ago, you'd drive, or I'd go on the bus myself, up and down Ashland Avenue. Go far enough, you'll see vacant storefront after vacant storefront. I mean, all those storefronts are heated, by the way, because you can't have the pipes bursting. And I talked to a friend of mine who's in real estate. I said, why is this? You know, certainly they would want to be able to, like, rent out the space for just a song, you know, some, you know, totally marginal retailer or whatever. It'd be better than just leaving it vacant. You know, there's got to be people who want to use this. And it has everything to do with the tax code. It's more profitable to keep it vacant and heated and have no retail, let alone homeless people in there, according to our federal tax code, than it is to actually help people. This is where people could be housed. These storefronts that are vacant. All these, by code, all these condo developments that happen on places like Clark Street and so forth, they're required to have first floor retail. But of course, we know what's happened to retail over the last few years, so it's more profitable to keep it vacant rather than to house people. Yeah, and look who owns that property. I think you'll find out what his or her campaign donations are. I didn't get a chance to go into it, but it really is quite astounding. One thing from the Tribune: with the February 2019 mayoral election still a year and a half away, Emanuel has collected $3.1 million in high-dollar contributions. More than $2.1 million of it, nearly 70%, has come from 83 donors who have benefited from actions at City Hall. Nearly 60% of the mayor's roughly 100 most loyal contributors received City Hall benefits and showed that many of those top donors regularly met with Emanuel, a level of access provided to few in the city. This was thanks to the Tribune and Better Government Association. This is how our city is run. This is who it's run for. And if you don't have that kind of cash, you're not going to get a meeting with the mayor, let alone get him to do what you want to do. The large gifts that go various non-governmental organizations who often seem more concerned with being able to report that they're doing good work rather than doing good work, and maintaining offices and maintaining high salaries of their executive directors. I mean, the LGBTQ movement is littered with organizations such as this, like the NGLTF, it's now the National LGBT Task Force or the Human Rights Campaign, but you can point to any number of similar organizations in other sectors where the whole notion seems to be, let's justify our funding, let's justify our staffing, let's justify our operating budget, rather than doing the things that they're set up to do. And they can often, when it comes time to, frankly, chop the head off the damn politicians who are most at fault, they will pull their punches because they hope to be able to negotiate and get funding thanks to the good offices of those same politicians. And it can be, as someone who's been involved in I think, truly grassroots political activity for many, many years, I find that very disgusting, and you see the divide and rule that's often done between the truly grassroots, for example, anti-police brutality organizations and those that are of an NGO model that are dependent upon funding and staffing and so forth. We've seen this many times over the decades in my experience. That said, it can be overcome. And one of the instances that I point to when the city finances were also a mess as they are today was how we got our city of Chicago per capita AIDS budget tripled in the matter of course, of about a week's time, as I recall. This is when city of Chicago was way behind the eight ball in terms of funding its per capita AIDS patients, services for them, behind that of New York and San Francisco, for example. And the then alderman of the 46th Ward, Helen Schiller, introduced a bill, and she was the only one who supported it, saying that, yeah, we should have funding on a par per capita, per AIDS patient, as they have in New York and San Francisco. This is something the city of Chicago needs right now. This is how we can help, you know, deal with this epidemic. And people heretofore had been basically be doing individual social service stuff where people, you know, particularly gay men as well as our allies, were caring for people who were dying and so forth. And Richard M. Daley came to Uptown during an ACT UP demonstration. Big mistake. Big, big, big mistake. And he was surrounded by about 1,000 of us. Now, I didn't wish I could take credit for organizing this demonstration. Really can't. I was just there. And people weren't having it. They were uncompromising. They were not listening to his words, the sort of Kaplan-esque words that we often hear about the homeless today, where, oh, I care about the issue, I care about people, you know, being put at risk and so forth. They weren't having it. And the look of fear that swept over his face and that of his big, burly bodyguards was a sight to behold. Because within days, the city of Chicago council that had only one vote in favor of this ordinance suddenly passed it overwhelmingly, and the city of Chicago AIDS budget on a per capita basis was tripled. That was just one experience that I can relate. I've seen other instances. Very, you know, I introduce myself as someone who's had some experience with the practical application of the First Amendment on the streets of Chicago. Following the release of the Laquan McDonald murder video by Chicago police, people flooded into the streets. They forced the Emanuel administration, as you know, powerful as it is, as it has had the city council in its back pocket, it forced it on its back heels. People were taken to the streets without permits, which I was like heartened by, because I've seen any number of times where the city of Chicago has stopped us from doing stuff, stopped us from having effective protests by use of its permit laws into just changing the faces at the top. Believe you me, going into 2019, Rahm Emanuel, with any luck, will be hearing a lot more of 16 shots and a cover-up.